Okay, Barbara, thanks a lot. Our next presentation is by the working group that has been examining the lessons learned for the auditing profession that may be learned by the auditing profession that may be learned from the recent financial crisis. The working group, led by Barbara Roper, includes Michael Head, Damon Silvers, Ann Simpson, and Tony Sondi. I understand that Brandon and Pete Nactway also made contributions to this presentation. When the Investor Advisory Group discussed this topic at its last meeting, it was combined with a discussion of the possible creation of an anti-fraud center at the PCAOB, and some members suggested that such a center could examine not only instances of possible fraud, but also systemic risk to financial reporting beyond fraud. The center then could publish information in an anonymized form that might assist auditors and others to look forward to find where the next fraud or significant market event might occur. The board is continuing to consider the formation of such a center. And with that introduction, Barbara, I turn it over to you, and thank you very much.
Great. And thanks to all of my working group members for their help in putting this together. I'm not going to repeat at length what I said earlier this morning, but I would like to run through and highlight some points. Just basic introduction to the issues that we were trying to address as part of this working group. Our basic assumption is that auditors, or perhaps it's fairer to say audits, failed to perform their basic public watchdog function in the financial crisis. And we believe that there's a need to figure out why they failed to perform that function and what can be done to fix that problem. We thought we fixed it when we passed Sarbanes-Oxley Act. We sought to make auditors more independent and to give audit committees more control over the audit, with the idea that that would make auditors more willing to stand up to management in their review of financial reports. We created the Public Accounting Oversight Board to raise the standards for auditors and hold auditors accountable for meeting those standards, in the hopes that that would improve the quality of audits, and that together these would give investors financial statements that they could rely on to give them the information they were looking for when they invested in public companies. The recent financial crisis, in essence, provided the first major massive test of the effectiveness of those Sarbanes-Oxley Act reforms. And, you know, by any objective measure, at least from the point of view of investors, they failed that test. This is just a sampling of the financial institutions, major global financial institutions, that failed or were sold in fire sales or were prevented from failing by virtue of massive government intervention, all of which had received unqualified audit opinions within months of the failure. And as you see, all of the audit firms represented with clients on that list. And I think the point that Damon made earlier is exactly the right one. If the auditors were performing as they should, and this is the result we get, then there's a problem with the system that says that's an appropriate audit. It may not be a problem with the auditor. That's why I said earlier it may be fairer to say that audits rather than auditors failed to perform their function. But I think it's impossible to look at that list and not at least raise questions about whether auditors didn't play a fairly significant role in the financial crisis. Some of the obvious areas, did their failure to adequately test valuations help companies to hide significant information? Did their deteriorating financial condition from investors? PCAOB inspectors found that auditors in some cases were not adequately testing valuations. How did that play into the financial crisis? Did they allow companies inappropriately to hire risks off balance sheet? Again, PCAOB inspectors found that in some cases they were not adequately testing whether it was appropriate for those to be treated as off-balance sheet assets. So, you know, what role did that play in causing the financial crisis? Did they agree to, or perhaps even help to design, transactions whose sole purpose was to hide from investors the degree of leverage that companies were taking on? And if the answer to those questions is yes, and many have suggested that the answer to those questions is yes, it at the very least raises concerns that, as the UK Financial Services Authority said, they showed a worrying lack of professional skepticism. But if the answer to those questions is yes, it may not only have deprived shareholders of information, but contributed to a situation in which lack of transparency helped to freeze the credit markets and really worsened the financial crisis. So this is a significant issue that needs to be addressed. As I said earlier, we're told that part of the problem here is an expectations gap. Investors have unreasonable expectations about what they can expect from the audits of public companies. I provided some, and you have in your packets, some of the things that have been written by independent observers, which express a high degree of frustration, anger, cynicism, that's really troubling, you know, as a statement about the lack of investor confidence in financial reporting and auditors of financial reports, and even raise questions about whether the audit itself, if it can't do a better job, has become irrelevant. And contrast that with statements from some of the audit firms themselves, which express less concern, shall we say. And in fact, in some cases, seem to express a degree of complacency about the current situation. And if this is indeed the best we can expect from audits, it does really raise significant questions about what the value to shareholders is, investors is, of, you know, the audited financial statements. For the most part, at least in this country, the auditors have sort of escaped repercussions. They haven't gotten a lot of attention from Congress, which, as I say, has largely proved to be a good thing, given what Congress chose to do in this area. And the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, you know, had sort of its hands full with all of the issues it was supposed to address. There is actually, if you look for it, quite a bit of information in the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report that is interesting. If your concern is about lack of transparency on financial reports, if your concern is about some of the relationships that appear to have existed between auditors and some of the companies and the role of this. And in the slides, I've highlighted a few of the cases. The report gives most attention to the issue of AIG, Goldman Sachs, and PricewaterhouseCoopers, which was auditor to both of those firms. And there are some sort of interesting and, at least to me, kind of shocking things that you come across if you dig into that report, like the fact that at the point when Goldman Sachs started pushing AIG for collateral, AIG Financial Products didn't have a model or otherwise try to value the CDO portfolio that it guaranteed through credit default swaps. So the company had an exposure of $79 billion, and the parent company's, you know, total reported capital is $95.8 billion. They don't have a model for valuing that exposure, and that seemed to be fine. They got no questions, apparently, from their auditor about that problem. And, in fact, their auditor, like many of the executives at the company, didn't even know that there were collateral provisions in these contracts. So, you know, this huge risk that ultimately brought down the company that isn't apparently on anybody's radar screen, that would seem to be relevant information. And And then the other sort of event specific to this audit that was highlighted in that report is that the auditor, to its credit, had started raising some serious questions about the risk management practices, the valuation practices at AIG. They had concluded that, and they had serious problems with a value that AIG had reported to shareholders in December about taking a negative basis adjustment to reduce from $5.1 billion to $1.5 billion their loss estimate from their CDOs. But they let that disclosure go out to investors in December. It wasn't until February that they brought it up with the board. And, you know, I have to ask, along with the FCIC, you know, why the auditors waited so long to make this pronouncement, that there was a material weakness in their controls, is unclear, particularly given that PwC had known about the adjustment in November. So November to February, they know about it, they're concerned about the controls, but they let that information go out to shareholders. So those, you know, as I say, so there's some things that have come out, and then there's another in the report. They also, not in the report itself, but on the website, there's a document with regard to Citigroup that raises some serious questions about the role of the auditor, given that a week after Citigroup had gotten a report from the OCC that their controls were a mess, they put out a financial statement that said everything's fine, and the auditor signed it and attested to the quality of controls. That strikes me as another area we could stand to get, you know, better insight into, you know, how common were those practices, why? I mean that's the big question in all of this, that I think, why does that happen? And then, as I said, the PCAOB has done its own report, and it actually, you know, it is a useful document. It provides some very beneficial information, you know, insights into some of the problems that occurred that logically one might expect played a role in the financial crisis, the problems that the inspectors found with regard to fair value measurement and off-balance sheet structures being sort of at the top of the list of seeming like areas that deserve more study. But that report is just a starting point, in our view. There are a couple of reasons. Its focus is on the effect of the financial crisis on audits rather than the role of audits in the financial crisis. It prevents its information in very generalized terms, and most importantly, it identifies where auditors fail to perform up to standards, but it does not attempt to analyze why those failures occurred or what needs to be done to prevent or minimize the chances of a recurrence. So, as I say, it provides a valuable starting point for the kind of further review that we think is necessary, but a starting point only. So, as I said, in this country, there's been relatively little attention to these issues up to this point. You have to sort of dig for the nuggets in other documents, but we think a more in-depth study needs to be done. Anne is going to talk a little bit about what's going on in the EU and the UK, where they have begun to look much more extensively about some of these issues that we think should be delved into in this country as well.
Thanks very much, Barbara. Well, thank you to the whole of this group. We had some very good discussions, and I must say, Barbara, thank you very much for leading it, because it was not an easy crowd to get together and an almost impossible task. You know, what went wrong? Why did it go wrong? What should the PCAOB be doing about it? So I think Barbara set the scene very well for what our concerns are. And my task, at Steve Harris's suggestion, is to take a look at what's being done internationally, give you some of the highlights, and we hope this presents a menu of ideas for the PCAOB, because these big questions about why the watchdogs didn't bark. These questions are being asked in other jurisdictions, but the US is the largest capital market in the world. It's the market where the home market for the big four audit firms, and it's just phenomenally important that the PCAOB takes this agenda up. So, you know, our congratulations to the appointment to the new board members. We really think this is an important issue. So in just a few minutes, what I'd like to do is give you a flavour for the different initiatives that are there. We've put together a six-inch file of these various projects that are going on internationally. And for that, I'd like to thank Mary Morris and her team at CalPERS for doing the background work. But if anyone is interested in the projects that I'm going to refer to, please let me know. We'd be delighted to send you the links. So the first thing I want to say is that there are at least a dozen different inquiries that have been launched in different countries. And I'm only going to talk about Europe. All due respect to Asia, Latin America, and other parts of the world, this really is a European discussion. And I just want to read off the titles of some of them to give you a sense of the scope. So the Financial Reporting Council, their project, Enhancing Corporate Reporting and Audit, a separate report on auditor skepticism, the Auditing Practices Board, ethical standards for auditors, again, the FRC, audit committees and non-audit services, and then an audit firm governance code issued by the Institute of Chartered Accountants in England and Wales, which is really trying to get at this whole agenda of the governance of the audit networks without having to wait for some global legislative initiative. So there's been a very wide and diverse range of activity, but I think the key inquiry is being led by the European Commission, which has issued a green paper towards the end of last year, which was framed on the theme of lessons learned from the financial crisis - audit policy. And I just want to give you the full quote, which Steve touched on earlier, which Michel Barnier, the European Commissioner, who's responsible for this, conveyed a real sense of urgency when this, in February, just last month, when this project had an open meeting on all the submissions they've gathered so far. And this is what he said. The title of his speech was Audit 2011, and in French, the title was L'année de l'audace, which I think loosely translates into the audit as audacity. But he sees this, I would say, as a loose translation, as time to get on with it. And no holds barred. This is an opportunity for a root and branch, fresh look at what's going on the audit. So this is how the paper is framed. He says, and this was what Steve mentioned earlier, the status quo is not an option for the auditing world. It's not about changing for the sake of change, but to reply to the very real needs which we can no longer ignore. So there's a discussion which will seem very familiar to the United States about what went wrong and how shocking it was that nothing was mentioned in audit reports. However, I think what's interesting about this project, and maybe for the PCAOB worth looking at, and our investor group would certainly encourage you to go in this direction, is how broadly they're framing their questions. So let me give you some examples, certainly the ones that caught my eye. On the audit industry, first question. This isn't their language in the question. Please understand, this is me giving you highlights. I'm sure they do have a far more subtle way of putting it. This is my take as an investor of what they're asking. So first of all, how have the global big four firms become a systemic risk in themselves? And the question that follows from that, do we need to take measures to introduce the equivalent of living wills or measures too big to fail, which obviously have been preoccupying reform initiatives around financial institutions? And in that regard, they're interested in this idea of living wills. What would that look like for the big, for another collapse of an audit firm? And transitional support, for example, through joint audits or a move to audit consortia. So that to me is a very eye-popping thought, and something really worth thinking about. Their second big question, which is about the way audit firms are currently organized, has the partnership model reached its limit? Is it time for both restructuring and also downsizing? It's another part of addressing their concerns about systemic risk with the Big Four. And that would also be an opportunity, they think, for us to consider allowing new corporate forms to be developed, raise capital, and help with entry for new players. Third big issue that they put on the table, is the supervisory system truly independent of the audit firms? Parts of the standard-setting world are receive funding directly from and also have representative seats for members of the audit profession, and they would really like to look at that again and see whether it compromises independence. Another fundamental question, should auditing ever be provided alongside other commercial services? Should auditing even be a commercial service? They pose the question, in certain circumstances, should the audit actually be conducted by a non-commercial body? Should it be a regulatory or a supervisory body that goes in to do the audit, for example, of systemically important financial institutions? So we cannot criticise Barnier for being timid. This is no shrinking violet there in Brussels. But there's more. Let's turn now to what they're asking about the role of the auditor, sort of taking the whole industry. There's a whole section of the inquiry which is about the industry itself. Next thing, about the role of the auditor. And here are a few highlights from the questions that they're asking. So, have we got to a situation where the reasonable assurance provided by auditors is less concerned with risk, which is what it's meant to have been concerned with, and more concerned with simple conformity to standards? And have we gone, we've lost substance over form, an issue that was touched on earlier. Secondly, should the audit methodology be communicated to stakeholders? Note, interesting, as this is Europe, it's not shareholders, it's stakeholders. And in particular, and I think this is very interesting, thinking about Damon's comment about valuations on you know, around mortgages and mortgage securitization and derivatives products run from those. Should we in particular have substantive verification of the balance sheet, which is part of a bigger question they're asking about getting audit, should we be thinking about audit going, as they put it, back to basics, rather than focusing on processes, which perhaps are more properly the task of management. So that's, they're not answering the question, but they're asking it. They also have a section on auditor behaviour. This is sort of auditor anthropology, I suppose. What could be done to foster professional scepticism? And part of that, obviously, is independence and objectivity, which we've touched on. Part of it is training. Part of it is reward and incentives. But it is a behavioural question. It's not something that, that you can define easily. And also they spend some time asking questions which we have touched on here about how do we move away from an up or down yes-no answer with the audit opinion. And they do actually ask some interesting questions about if you did have an auditor's discussion and analysis, you don't want a lot of fluff. You do want something useful. You don't want to stray into being vague again. So there's some real discussion around that. And finally, they do flag up, should auditors also be opining on material, environmental and social risks? And I think we've seen companies, you know, even in the US, where the risks being run on environmental issues have proven to be material. So that does, of course, pose a question about what the auditors might be doing about that. So let me just finish with their wrap-up questions, which if we could find a group of ideas or issues for the PCOB to tackle, I suggest it would be captured in this less than a dozen questions. So first, do you believe that audits should provide comfort on the financial health of companies, and are audits fit for such a purpose? So to bridge the expectation gap and in order to clarify the role of audit, should the audit methodology employed be better explained to users? Thirdly, should professional scepticism be reinforced, and how could this be achieved? Fourth, should the negative perception attached to qualification in audit reports be reconsidered, and if so, how? Is there adequate and regular dialogue between the external, internal auditors and the audit committee? We touched on that in Anne's discussion. If not, how can it be improved? Do you think auditors should play a role in ensuring the reliability of information companies are reporting in the field of corporate social responsibility? Should there be more regular communication by the auditor to the stakeholders, and should the time gap between the year end and the date of the audit opinion be reduced? And then my favourite, which I think could keep everyone occupied for a very long time, what other measures could be envisaged to enhance the value of audits, which I'd be fascinated when they do publish their comments to see what else people came up with. So I think I would recommend this particular initiative at the European Commission to the PCAOB board for consideration. Chunks of it are not relevant. They're about how do people in Finland go and audit companies in Germany and, you know, all manner of things very particular to Europe. But I think what I find valuable is the willingness to put everything on the table, even if they don't have the answers, and to have a very broad-ranging inquiry to see what might come back. They're planning to come back with proposals later this year, but I certainly think we might. I'm sure you're already in touch with your counterparts in the European Commission on these issues, but I'm sure they'd find it valuable to, you know, be helping shape the agenda that we hope the PCAOB will take up. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Tony?
I've been tasked with giving you a sense of the recommendations from our working group, but I wanted to make two points before I get into that. Barbara, in her excellent job earlier, was talking about the AIG reported capital, and she mentioned that 80% of it was so-and-so. I wonder how many people are aware that of the AIG Financial Products unit, the unit that actually imploded, roughly 80% of its capital actually came from the deferred compensation of the CEO of that unit. How much comfort do you think an investor derives from the fact that 80% of the capital that stands behind the company comes from the deferred compensation of the CEO? The second point that I want to make is that if you think about disclosures and what's happening with them, recognition and measurement today is insufficient to provide an adequate picture. So the numbers that you see in a set of financial statements, the only way to understand them, I think, is to be able to read the footnotes and understand what they're talking about. So if you have footnotes that are boilerplate and you have footnotes that are not being audited, there's an extraordinary amount of a gap in there. That deficiency, I think, is rather significant. I think I've mentioned this before here. When I first went to the EITF at the FASB, I made a comment that in coming up to the building, I had seen a sign outside that said that accounting is not discussed after 4 p.m. on Fridays. And below it, it said that disclosure, however, cannot be discussed before 4:30 p.m. on Fridays. I wonder what that similar sign is for the auditors. Does it mention when or whether they even talk about disclosures? And I want to be very clear. I'm not talking about the people from the accounting firms who serve on the EITF or go on to serve on the FASB. I know they are aware of disclosures. I'm talking about the field auditors. What are the processes that they follow about with respect to disclosures, with respect to auditing those? And I think that's where we're finding some of the problems. Now to the recommendations. Our first recommendation is that the PCAOB launch an in-depth study into the role of the auditors and the audit, as you've clarified, in the financial crisis, as enablers maybe of the financial crisis. I think the objective, the objective should be that we need to identify the causes of the pervasive audit failures and then propose and, in a timely fashion, implement remedies to those. The working group also recommends that the PCAOB make this in-depth analysis an ongoing part of your process. Another set of recommendations or thoughts, I think it's time to revisit SOP 94-6 on disclosures of significant risks and uncertainties. I think if you think about the fact that that particular disclosure requirement didn't really help us very much with this last crisis, maybe we need to update that and take a look at it. I think, for example, if you look at, as Lynn had mentioned, Enron, WorldCom, and some of the other companies that were part of or responsible for the crisis, earlier crisis, I should say, those disclosures did tell you a fair amount. But you had to go through them. You had to read them. But they did not, no matter how well you analyze those, they did not give you the full scale of the problems. So I think we need to do something about 94-6. I think we need to reconsider the audit procedures as they relate to liquidity, financial flexibility, and off-balance sheet financial statement assets and liabilities. So I'm expanding it from risks, not just the off-balance sheet risks. And this, again, with respect to financial flexibility, the off-balance sheet, I remember organizing a conference about off-balance sheet risks in 1984. And Lynn had pointed out earlier that one hopes that 7 years would be sufficient. But I've actually done an analysis, Lynn. If it takes the FASB 7.5 years, they normally don't reach a conclusion. One outlier on that is control and consolidations, which they quit after 23.5 years. So I think that we need to look at those. By the way, I'm not making these numbers up. You can actually look them up if you want. And then finally, I think another point that has been made before, and specifically by Lynn, and that is we need to be very, very clear about where and what the responsibilities of the PCAOB, for example, are when inspections turn up problems with the application of the accounting standards. We need to be very, very clear because that's one of the most difficult areas. Is the problem with the way the standard was written? Is the problem with the way it's being implemented? Or is it an issue of audits? And I'm not suggesting that it's always going to be straightforward, and that may be one of the most difficult recommendations to consider. But I think it's critical, and I certainly will be happy to answer any questions.
Just two small points. We were well aware that the board, like any organization, has its own resource limitations, and we're not privy to the internal investigations that the board is undertaking. But despite the potential breadth of the postmortem that we described, we do think it's critical that we undertake such an inquiry, not with a view toward necessarily assigning blame, but literally with a view toward trying to learn what we need to do to change things on a going forward basis, so that to the extent the board feels it's necessary to skinny down or otherwise target the breadth of what we've described, we do think that that inquiry is worthwhile, or otherwise it will just drift into dust. But we recognize that there will be resource limitations, and we don't think that duplication is appropriate. Second, we debated, as Tony's careful remarks highlighted, what we recognize to be the potential boundary issues between standard setting and implementation. We think, if anything, those boundary issues argue for this inquiry. Because when you have a split between standard setters and enforcers, as you will, there is enormous potential for gaps to develop. The standard setters may or may not appreciate what the enforcers are finding, and the enforcers may feel limited in their ability to make recommendations regarding standard setting. So if anything, we thought that that split argues for taking a very careful assessment of what did happen on the ground, potentially with a view toward either making recommendations with respect to standard setting or enhancing the coordination between standard setters and fact finders. So that rather than be a limitation on such an inquiry, we see it as an opportunity to enhance the flow of information between and the benefits from coordination between standard setters and fact finders.
Well, Barbara Ann Tony and Brandon. I think that was extraordinarily helpful. Why don't I turn it over, Mr. Chairman, to you or others that have questions, and I'll have some of my own as well.
Thank you, Steve. To go to the last one first, I think it's important and useful to know that we do reevaluate the forms, the inspection forms and the materials we employ in inspections. And I take it that one of the things that may be useful is if you're suggesting in the basic formatting of an inspection, if some careful attention be given to areas where the inspection team finds what it thinks may have been an issue of standard application or misinterpretation of the statute, of the standard. And I think that's something that that the people behind me in Helen Munter's division are giving a lot of thought to now. But with respect to the first one, the big one, of the ongoing study, and I very much appreciate the focus you've given it, Brandon and Tony, is it the group's sense that we ought to hit certain of the instances, for example, mention was made of the Citicorp letter from the OCC. I mean, not to seize on that, but is it your suggestion that we take some of the major examples, and when you say determine what happened on the ground, try to go into this from an audit inspection review of an audit issue? Is that your recommendation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that would have to be a part of what would happen. We have, you know, to pick a few examples and really dig in to find out. And I think, I mean, we're assuming that some of what you will find will have to do with things that aren't directly within the purview of the PCAOB. For example, you may find that in some areas what you see is a problem, you know, a fundamental problem with the accounting standards. But I would say, you know, similar to what Brandon was saying, that rather than just sort of set that aside as not in your purview, one of the things I would hope that this board would look at is whether the standards are not auditable. So, but to your main point, yes, I would think focusing in on, you know, maybe what, half a dozen or whatever, you know, cases to see what happened, you know, really dig into the details of, you know, what went wrong or what, you know, didn't go wrong, but nonetheless led to the conclusion that it did. But also to look, you know, sort of more big picture in some of the ways that the Europeans are doing it, at some of these issues about culture and incentives and independence and skepticism and, you know, that are broader than the individual case analysis. But I think one of the reasons we've called for a specific in-depth study is that we think we know some things about what went wrong, but we don't know what we don't know. And we don't know a lot about why. And so I think those are some of the answers we'd like to get to.
And in the process, we may find examples. There may be information that comes to us that indicates a breakdown of basic governance models that we all agree on, a tipping point when communications cease to go to the audit committee at a studied diversion of attention from what the activities of a subsidiary were or what a unit were. Those are things we would normally bring to the attention of the commission, and I guess what you're suggesting is that if we do have a study like that, that might be the way to give appropriate publicity and attention to them. 21A reports, I think, are still done at the commission, and that might lead. You're urging us to keep, as we go into these situations case by case, to keep the blinders off and think about what might make the appropriate substance of a Commission 21A report on a broader front. And I think that's a very helpful thing. I did want to get back to Ann's emphasis on the green paper, and I appreciate the irony of your remarks about their not being modest, they're being ambitious. Not to describe them as either utopian or Orwellian, it did seem to me that in as you went through the list, you went through through issues that were being raised by them that had a particularly continental flavor to them. And as you got more specific, you got more into the areas in which we could, as a board, proceed, as you said earlier, effectively and efficiently. And I want to be sure that that's a consensus that I'm discerning from what you're saying, that, in fact, appreciating the boldness of raising the question of whether firms are too big to fail and whether they ought to be broken up and whether someone ought to do the audit besides private firms, all of which are in the list. Is it a matter of recognition that our role should get to how we affect the conduct of auditors in this financial crisis, where they may be seen or perceived to have suspended skepticism, or where they may have interpreted their rules on the application of GAAP as not to require a broader horizon on what was going on, and therefore dealing with what the auditor's report is, dealing with what can be audited under the standards and what we do audit, dealing with how the audit firm relationship works with the audit committee. Are we, in your view, going down the right track by hitting those issues and not dealing with whether firms should be corporations, whether they should be broken up by an economic regulatory authority?
Well, that's difficult because you want to be practical.
Yes.
But I think if we don't have some space to actually talk about the structure of the audit industry, we won't actually be able to grapple with issues like independence. It's very tough. It may be that one way to go here is that if the European Commission has actually set the debate running about, because they've got the same big four. I mean, it's the same big four that the European Commission are looking at, that the same big four that would be here. So it may be that one decision your group could take is to say, let's see what the Commission comes out with later in 2011. We might return to that question of the structure of the audit industry. Meanwhile, we can get on with some very specific work that related to the US market and make progress. But I think I think these are interconnected.
You believe they're interconnected?
I believe they are, yes.
Can I add one point on that? You know, I guess what I would assume, I'm generally comfortable with what you're saying about what you think the focus should be. If, as a result of your fact-finding, you discover that there are certain things about the structures and governance and whatnot of the audit firms that's directly related to the reasons we're having problems with lack of professional skepticism or lack of independence, then I think those issues come back, you know, back into play. I also think it's a separate issue, perhaps, but I don't know whether the audit firms are a systemic risk. They are clearly too big to fail. And what does that mean in terms of the willingness or ability to take, you know, tough enforcement actions against them? And does that play into an environment in which the audit firms feel that they are sort of insulated from accountability when they do fail? So I think to the degree that you look at some of those bigger structural issues, it ought to be driven by what you find once you go in and do the spade work and find out what went wrong.
I think that's very wise, and I take it to heart. I'm fond of asking whether anybody can give me an example of a major firm that failed through private civil enforcement, through a regulatory civil enforcement action. I mean, it seems to me that that our job is not to worry about the collateral effects of regulatory civil enforcement, but to decide what has to be enforced. But I think these are all very stimulating and well put.
Tony, wanted to circle back. This is Jay Hansen. Circle back to one of the things you said, and you mentioned this arcane reference to SOP 94-6, which was the translation for the non-accountants in the room, as this is a standard that was issued back in 1994 that effectively said companies should disclose more about the risks and uncertainties of their operations and the estimates and the financial statements. And your point about does that need to be revisited, that's another a fundamental question of, well, is there something wrong with the standard or is there something wrong with the application? And another poster child example that my chairman, Mr. Doty, and I have talked about, and Mr. Croker has been on the stump talking about this, is disclosure about litigation, that there's a principle that's been out there since FASB number 5, so back in the early 70s, has been out there that says if you've got litigation exposure or contingency exposure that has not been accrued for in the financial statements, I don't remember the exact words, but it's effectively disclose some stuff about it that will give the reader some idea of how big of an issue it could be. And the FASB has taken a couple different bites at an apple of trying to say, well, it's not working right now today with disclose some stuff, and so here's 10 pages of granular things to disclose. And well-meaning lawyers like Mr. Doty say, no, you can't do that because that will compromise the case and everything else. And Jim, I think the current discussions at some of the recent conferences and communications to the issuers are you need to disclose more stuff. We'll back off on the standard for now, but if we have to put in the standard to be more granular, we'll do that. But it's kind of a poster child example of the challenge of trying to mandate exactly what a company should disclose, and you get what we have today, which was hundreds of pages of footnotes that investors have a hard time wading through to figure out, well, what's important here? It can't all be of equal importance, but it might actually comply with the requirements, but it really doesn't tell the story. And it's one of the challenges that issuers face and auditors face and we face as we're inspecting to say, do the financial statements really tell the story? And there's a lot of players involved in fixing that problem, and I'm not sure that we can do it by ourselves. But Tony, back to maybe the question that I want to frame up here, do you think there's really a problem with the standards? Is it really an application of the standards on some of these softer areas that the investors clearly want more information?
Jay, I do believe that there are areas where there's a problem with the standards. I also agree with you with respect to 94-6. On the disclosure of significant risks and uncertainties. I think that standard, and I remember spending a lot of time when it was being developed and working with some people on it as well, and it had all the signs and indicators of being a good standard. It has unfortunately not resulted in the kind of information that we would need. So that one clearly appears to be an issue of how it's applied and what we're missing in the implementation. But on the other hand, I don't think that – I'm not ready to say that there isn't an issue to look at in terms of how audits are performed and so on. And what I wanted to also mention, FAS 5, by the way, is also an excellent example, because if you read it and what it says about the probability of when you have to provide disclosures and how it's actually applied, you see two different worlds. And I don't care who's responsible for making those two worlds the way they are. The problem is that, which is why I said I don't. My point is that as an investor, I always find that I get information about liabilities and those kinds of risks later than I would want it. To go back to one more just brief comment, Jim, you had asked a question that Barbara and Anne have certainly responded to very well, but I just wanted to point out that I cannot think of a more critical study where the design is going to be more important. So when you were talking about how one should go about it, I think it's the design that's going to be fundamentally critical to how this gets done. And I think what Jay has been saying contributes to that. So I think it's critical that we're very careful about how this is designed and the questions you ask yourself as you proceed through it, through this particular study. The other thing that I want to be very clear about is I see a lot of studies. I see a lot of announcements. Unfortunately, the follow-through is rarely something worth writing home about. For example, the Europeans have looked at their banks, but I think that if you just simply look at the amount of information that's missing in the stress tests, it's unfortunate because I don't think it gives you, as an investor, it does not help me and does not make me comfortable with respect to the banks in France and Germany when they tell me that their own regulators are permitting them not to provide. And by the way, I don't mean to single out those. We do the same thing around here at different levels. The point, though, is that I think the study needs to be designed carefully and carried through very, very carefully as well.
I'd like to come back to something that Barbara said about the firms and too big to fail. I would hope that this board would never view these firms as too big to fail, that in fact, if the firms had got in trouble in the marketplace and weren't living up to their obligations and as a result faced a dilemma that would cause the demise of one, I do think you ought to let the private sector work then and let the firm fail. I think it's very wrongful for the government to support inefficient and ineffective organizations, and so I would hope that people wouldn't on this board view these as too big to fail. I would also hope that the board would not wait for the EC to do something. I would hope that this board would be very proactive and try to get ahead of the ball game rather than just following what the EC has done. The EC at times over the years has talked a great story at the beginning and then not really delivered. And if you're waiting for that, I think you'd be wasting and getting behind time. On the professional skepticism issue, I've been in this profession for 3.5 decades now. And every single decade, there's been some event occur, or a number of events occur, where questions have given rise to the question of why weren't the auditors more skeptical. It certainly gives rise to the question of whether or not the fundamental issue is not whether they were skeptical, but whether they were really, truly independent. And I think we'll talk about that after lunch today. But besides dealing with the independence issue, which I think you have to deal with, I think you also have to understand that the number one vehicle for dealing with the lack of skepticism is to hold the auditor accountable. And that is done through your enforcement arm. And I know we have to wait to see what happens, but we've been waiting 9 years now to see what happens. And I think that's long enough. I think it's fair for the public now to actually see something come out. But I think nothing would influence auditors in the field more than seeing some auditors who didn't live up to their professional obligations hit with some steep penalties, if you will. And I think that degree of accountability needs to be forthcoming. If you continue, and if the public continues to see coming out of this board a lack of meaningful enforcement actions, a real watchdog with teeth, then I think it's realistic to expect that auditors will behave accordingly and view the watchdog agency, not so much as a watchdog, but as a lapdog. It's just the way people behave. So I think a lot of that is up to the board to drive the behavior and what happens there. On the issue of the standards, first of all, there is a piece of this that falls into the three plates between the FASB, the SEC, and the PCAOB. But having said that, though, I don't think the PCAOB should be sitting there and saying, we got to wait for the other people before we can do anything. I think you divide the three pieces up, but then once the pieces are determined, then I think the PCAOB should move independently and aggressively, timely, quite frankly, to do something. We know, as we've talked about, the FASB is
you know, we've been waiting since 1978 for that standard on unusual transactions. You know, we could all be dead before we ever see anything out of that board the way they operate. And likewise, on 94-6, that is truly a standard problem. I don't think anyone really thought that standard was going to work when initially was put out by ACSEC. If you look at the original exposure draft, it had a very good disclosure and a much lower benchmark for having to disclose risk and uncertainties. And then when the business community came in and vehemently opposed that, and of course there were hardly any investors on ACSEC at the time, ACSEC totally folded the tent, watered it way down, created a benchmark for disclosure that you'd almost have to have a nuclear plant going burning up before you'd have to disclose it. And so, in fact, in that standard, it is a deficiency in the standard. People have known about that deficiency for a long time, and yet, again, this is a standard where we've known about it and no one's ever acted on it. Now we've had a meltdown, and it's unfortunately that, you know, members in my fund have had to go through that exposure and the damage to their retirement accounts because some regulators couldn't get out of their way and get something done. So I'd certainly urge that the PCOB move forward actively on their piece of the project and not wait for the other people to go do their stuff, or, you know, we may be going through another meltdown before we ever see anything happen.
Bob, why don't we go from you right the way around the table to the cards that are up, and then if anybody has any more, we ought to be mindful and break for lunch no later than 12:45.
Thanks, Steve. Bob Tirola speaking. Barbara, you said some things that really struck me. The notion that auditors could be part of the systemic risk, too big to fail. The auditing profession globally has a public franchise that is unique, and it seems to me has to be more transparent about how it does business, how it's organized, how it conducts its professional responsibility. And I wanted to go back to what Jay was mentioning about these various arcane ways that accountants deal with issues. But much of what we do is try to assess the degree to which something out of our control will affect the numbers that are being published. And whether you're accounting for those numbers or auditing those numbers, it's largely factors that are outside of your control that you're trying to address. And what I'm hearing from those who represent investors more directly than I is that you want to know how you make those judgments. And that's a fair question. And in some way, in the reporting framework, and maybe it's an auditor discussion or analysis, those sort of questions can be addressed. But I agree with my colleagues here that that this is, despite the fact that the auditors seem to escape repercussions, they could have, and maybe should have, been the group in the financial reporting supply chain that raised these issues along the way.
Steve, thank you. This is Norman Harrison. I'll be very brief. Also a follow-up to a comment that Barbara made when she was responding to a question about the proposed scope of the study that the working group has recommended, when she made the observation that one of the issues here is we don't know what we don't know. It occurred to me that one of the questions that has troubled me as we've read the various postmortems on the subprime meltdown and all of the failures around those incidents is, I think there's a fair question to be asked in some cases, did the auditors not know what they didn't know? And what I mean by that is, you know, in your any study you undertake, in your ongoing examination activities, I think it's important to focus on what mechanisms the firms have in place to ensure that they have requisite subject matter expertise. I mean, everyone at this table is in one form or another an observer of or a participant in the capital markets. I think the subprime issues are perhaps a vivid illustration of the complexity with which financial products are structured these days, and accounted for the speed with which they move and the number of parties involved in complex structured transactions. And I often wonder whether in many cases the auditors, you know, to give the benefit of the doubt, may have been asking good questions or the right questions, but did they have the subject matter expertise in-house to evaluate the credibility of the responses they were receiving from the issuer? And so I think that's an aspect of this that can't be overlooked as we look for lessons learned or perhaps, you know, guidance to provide going forward about how to try to ensure that things like this don't happen again.
A brief comment about what Norman just said. Unfortunately, we all base a lot of our judgments on what we've learned from the past, and we know what we know from the past, but we don't know what we know about the future. And it's very possible that an estimate for a particular firm could have been a good estimate, yet they were financially crumbling underneath. We just don't know that. There were plenty of people before the crisis meltdown that were saying there is trouble ahead, you know, there's a disaster. At the same time, there were plenty of people that said it's smooth sailing. So we are subject to not knowing what we don't know. But I think giving more information to more people, i.e. investors, certainly helps more people process that. The AIG case to me is really quite interesting. It points to several difficulties. One is accounting standards themselves. You know, perhaps better discussion about off-balance sheet financing, perhaps better discussion about fair value pricing. Those would certainly help in information. It certainly sounds like there was a breakdown in applying auditing principles in the case of AIG. But even if everything were done correctly in 2008 or even 2007, it wasn't going to stop the global financial crisis freight train that was coming at us. That was well in place, and ultimately there were a lot of loans that basically defaulted. I think one way we might have been able to have at least mitigated some of the damage was greater information to investors throughout the entire process. If we had greater disclosure, we knew that there were greater risks associated with balance sheets, perhaps as early as 2003 and 2004. We look back now, and it's quite clear that there was rot building in the system as early as 2003. If we had known that, the marketplace itself can send very strong signals and could have started to address some of these things before the bubble got to be the size that it did in real estate. And so, again, I go back to disclosure to investors, the audit report, or whether it's the ADNA. I think that would be a significant help in the whole process.
For purposes of the reassessment, I would urge the board to use its scarce fact-finding resources where those fact-finding resources can contribute to the debate in a meaningful manner, so that while I recognize the importance of some of the broader structural and other issues that have been raised on the continent, where I would hope that the board would focus on is trying, as Tony highlights, to design a study that can speak specifically to a process where we learn something at the end of the day. So purely as a thought example, not to suggest anything on a micro level, if you take Damon's observation from this morning about the extraordinary difficulty of valuing mortgage-backed securities and mortgage-related securities, and you took some of the examples Barbara gave, and you looked across, say, three different accounting firms, and then you looked at a firm that actually is viewed as successfully navigating the crisis, it would be an interesting question. How did four different auditing firms deal with that? You could come up with some comparables. You could look at how those comparables then played out through successive firm failures. You could compare and contrast that with facts on the ground about how the audits of successful firms dealt with that. My suspicion, my hypothesis going in, is that you would find that much of it was driven by the quality of the managements of those companies, much more so than the quality of the audits of those companies. But then you would develop a factual predicate that you could actually make some decisions on, and we would be smarter 18 months from now than where we are today. Because otherwise, I think that the facts will drift into the realm of competing mythologies and narratives by people with various stories to tell. And positions to advance, and that the board has a unique opportunity to set a baseline for some factual assessments. And then I would use what are very limited resources to try and answer questions where at the end of your study you might actually know something more than when you went into your study, as opposed to repeating a more broadly based structural debates that are, will produce multiple white papers.
Judge?
The interesting thing here is that, while we had, say, General Motors and Chrysler, I think you could understand what happened there. But look at the what you had. You had all these financial institutions that had the problems. It was a financial institution meltdown. Now, that ought to tell you something. And I think what you looked, and you can see the type of security that was involved, the securitized security, it tells us that we had what I referred to as the smartest guys on the block are inventing things, and nobody knows what how to deal with them. We got things that are exploding without an antidote as to how to deal with them when they go bad. We're creating viruses in the system. And it seems to me that we can – there's a lot that we can tell just from how to deal with this thing. I mean, the critical thing is to find out how to prevent it from happening in the future. The failures, the oversights and whatnot. But there obviously is something in that's created in the financial institutions that's causing or that caused the auditors of those financial institutions difficulty in being able to grasp that problem, what it was, and to be able to deal with it. In other words, if it's like a disease or something, you could isolate the germ. You ought to be able to isolate it here. We ought to be able. We know that we have a lot of cowboys around. We know we have a lot of lawyers around that are every day and are creating. You know, you have somebody creating something called synthetic securities. What the hell are we talking about? How do you have synthetic securities? Where? And you know, somebody's got to be saying, hey, you know, that can't happen. In my day, if we had some broker in Utah in Salt Lake City creating a synthetic security, you know where that person would have been? So there's certain things here that we can deal with, it seems to me. And to come critically and say, hey, wait a second, folks. Before we start creating these things that are going to destroy us, we ought to be able to test them to see what you need to be able to cope with them when they go out of control. And I think I really think a lot of the effort should be paid on how do we prevent this from happening. We keep looking to say, hey, what were the lessons learned? Yeah, but the lessons learned, it seems to me, that we're not a bunch of dummies. I think we can figure out what some of these were.
Barbara, do you want to get a word, and then the chairman, and then we'll break for lunch?
Yeah, I just wanted to make two final points. One, you know, on the design of the study, I would encourage you to think of yourself as the average three-year-old. You know, why? 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 I mean, what is part of the problem, but why is, you know, what we need to know if we're going to fix it? And the other thing is Brandon has said, and rightly so, is referred several times to the very limited resources. I would urge the SEC to approve a budget for this board that gives you more than very limited resources for this kind of inquiry.
Steve, thank you. These are extremely thoughtful comments. Very helpful. I wanted to leave one question for you all to think about over lunch. It's sort of the yang to Lin's yang about not being fixed on too big to fail or on some of these other issues. Let us suppose we do a well-designed focus study and we do come up with some structural or very significant changes in the practice of the audit, the audit profession, the industry, the way in which they can be addressed. And let's suppose also they are changes that have been around for a while and have been discussed over decades, but have never been the devil never having been worked out because they didn't have to be, the devil of the details. And let us suppose they're extremely expensive. Does it affect the view of this investor advisory group that, in fact, if the right things to do to restore objectivity and to enhance credibility in the audit and to make it something that investors can get meaningful information from and get comfort about the what stands behind it as in a test function, that is very expensive? Does it bother you, or where do you come out in terms of the valuation of what we do, the priorities, if we do things which make it much more expensive with the result that there are some companies or some aspirant issuers that can't do IPOs, can't afford the audit, and are essentially priced out of becoming public companies? Now, you may say, well, that's a draconian result. But let us suppose that the best changes are expensive changes. If you'll indulge that hypothesis with us, where do you come out on the value or how we go about doing that? I'm going back to something Gus said about the tipping point. To avoid the tipping point in AIG is a big issue in the minds of this board. So how do we balance those competing costs of excellence, value for the investor, and cost to the registrant?
And then I'd like to leave you with the thought for the afternoon, and Lynn, for your group potentially to think about and get any recommendations on what steps, if any, do you believe the PCAOB should take to, one, improve auditor objectivity, improve and boost the transparency of auditor skepticism, monitor conflicts of interest, Gus, which I know you spoke about at some length, at the last session, and police auditor independence. And so with that, I think you got enough to think about for lunch, and we'll look forward to reconvening at 1:45.